Once in a while, you must admit, it can be difficult to discern what the Spirit might be saying to God's people in one of the readings we've been presented with at worship. Difficult to discern what in a passage might warrant the response, "Thanks be to God." Today, I believe, I have the distinct pleasure of dealing with two of them at once. David capering before the ark, and John the Baptist's head being served up on the platter. Thank you, Sue, for assigning them to me. There's a reading from Paul, too, of course, but it's one of those passages of Pauline theology rhetoric so sublime that all you can do is fall down in silence before it and adore. So we're left with those two problematic passages. Let's deal with the gospel one first. Why is it here at all? After all, there's virtually no mention of Jesus in it, so in what way is it the gospel of Christ? And why is it here at this particular point in Mark's telling of the gospel story? Why is it here at all? In the first five chapters of Mark, as Nancy said in her sermon last week, for Jesus, things have been, for the most part, going spectacularly well. Healings abound. Demons are banished. Crowds crush in around him, hanging on every word, filled with astonishment and awe. And Mark, who is a very careful craftsman, now inserts this gruesome story of the beheading of John the Baptist. Why? I think he means to put all this good news in context, to remind us of the real world in which this fragile little kingdom bubble in Galilee is set. A world of empire, Roman occupation, Jewish collusion. A world where power and status and face are more important than morality. A world where a king puts holding onto power and favor in the sight of those around him above the dictates of conscience and plain human decency. It's politics. You have to do what the party wants, what the voters want, even if you know it's wrong. That kind of world. This is the world that Jesus has come to turn on its head, and it will be after his head too. Mark places the story here then first to put what goes before it in the context. But I think he places it here more for what comes after than for what has come before. Because the very next story he tells is the story of Jesus hosting a very different dinner party of his own. The dinner party where he feeds 5,000 ordinary people in the wilderness. Compare those two banquet stories, Herod's banquet of death and Jesus' banquet of life. Herod's feast is in the lavish palace. Jesus sets his table in a desert place. Herod's is a small, elite guest list. Jesus sits down with 5,000 ordinary people, the poor of the earth. After Jesus' feast, there are 12 baskets full of abundance left over. At Herod's feast, the leftover is death, the head of John the Baptist served up as if it were the last course of the meal. Feeding the hungry masses was never on Herod's agenda. Confronted by a hungry mob, his response would be the same as the disciples was there in the wilderness. Send them away. Jesus says, invite them to sit down. Herod's rich banquet brought no one satisfaction. But Jesus takes the little that his disciples bring, blesses and multiplies it so that there can be a banquet of life for everyone. So in his contrasting these two banquets, the platter of death and the bread of life, Mark presents us with a choice. Which real world will we pick? By which world's principles will we live? God or mammon? Because you can't serve both. Now, what about David dancing before the ark? A bit of background first. The Israelites are in more or less constant warfare with the Philistines. Think David and Goliath. The battle is going badly for the Israelites, and they have an idea. Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant, the chest that God instructed Moses to build at Mount Sinai to contain the stone tablets of the law given on that mountain, the chest which led the people of Israel on their journey through the wilderness. Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant onto the battlefield. With God literally fighting beside us, we'll surely win. Well, not so much. The Philistines capture the Ark, leaving the Israelites very red in the face indeed. In the meantime, things don't go well in the towns where the Philistines lodged the Ark. Statues of Dagon, their god, are found nose flat in the ground, their stone bodies shattered. People suffer terrible diseases. People die. So, after a few months, the Philistines have the bright idea. They're rather more brawn than brain, these Philistines. Think Goliath. They have a bright idea and they say, let's send it back. And they do. Eventually, it's found. And as we heard in today's first reading, it's brought back to Jerusalem, where eventually, when Solomon builds his temple, it will reside in the Holy of Holies until sometime far in the future, it simply disappears and is discovered again by Indiana Jones or is secreted away in a monastery in Ethiopia. Who knows? Today's reading about dancing before the ark seems all sweetness and light, but it leaves out some crucial verses in the middle that lend a distinctly darker hue to the narrative. At the beginning, David and the Israelites seem to be treating the newly found ark rather cavalierly. They piled it on a farmer's cart and are partying around it as it goes. I like the castanets. The road is rough, the cart is cumbersome, and oh no, the ark looks like it's about to tumble off onto the ground. We can't have that. So Uzzah, a priest who is standing close by, stretches out a hand to steady the ark, and God rewards him for his kindness by striking him dead. Clearly, you do not touch the ark of God. So David gets the point that maybe he's not going about this ark business with the right attitude. And he pulls the ark into a lay-by at the side of the road and leaves it there for 3 months while he figures out how, A, to get the ark where it belongs, and B, how to get it there without being struck dead. He works it out. The approach, he realizes, needs to be one of great respect. We have to honor the life and death mystery that is our God, keeping our distance even while we're in intimate contact with the divine presence. We've been taking God for granted, assuming we've got him in our back pocket. Not so, not so. And so the procession resumes, but in a very different mood. The ark is no longer carried on a cart, but presumably is carried as God instructed Moses it was to be carried, borne on long poles like a sedan chair, so that it can be moved without being touched. Every six paces is set down and sacrifices are offered. David, wearing, we're told, a linen ephod, a priestly vestment, dances. David alone. And we can be pretty sure that David's dance is choreographed very carefully, lest he put a foot wrong and end up like poor Uzzah. No more castanets, only the solemn tone of trumpets. We too can take God for granted. We can, as Nancy said last week, be jaded by religious over-familiarity. And that can mean that sometimes we mistake worship for entertainment. And that brings me to Annie Dillard and her 1982 essay, An Expedition to the Pole. Annie Dillard was not happy, to say the least, with what she was experiencing in worship back then. She felt people should approach worship the way explorers like Franklin and Scott approach their mission, aware, like them, that we are on a life and death undertaking. Instead, she says, the people around her were behaving like passengers on a cruise ship, tourists, as she puts it, on a package tour of the absolute. On the whole, she goes on, I do not find Christians sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea of what sort of power we so blithely invoke in worship? It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers as signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us out to where we can never return. We need at times to be reminded that we enter the holy, the presence of the holy, at our peril. Our loving God is the Lion of Judah, not a tame pussycat. So in the gospel, we are presented with a choice. Which world will we be part of? Which world will be ruled by? The world where politics and power trump ethics and conscience, or a world where compassion and good news for the poor is dedicated to abundant life for all? And in the story of David's dance, we are reminded that such a choice is a life and death choice. God is love, absolutely true. But one of the people in the Bible study group we had here during Lent and Eastertide said that that's just about all he ever hears about God these days, that God is love. And he has a sense that it just simply isn't enough. And he has a point. God's love warms us, but it burns with a passion for justice and holiness in response to that love. And we'd best be careful that we don't get our fingers burnt by forgetting that, or by taking God and God's utter holiness for granted in our worship or in our lives.